as you all know, you've just been told again, so you must know, I'm speaking tonight about Obadiah Holmes, who began his life in Reddish, which is now within the boundaries of Stockport, but which was then a village in the parish of Manchester in the county of Lancashire. And Holmes ended his life in Newport, Rhode Island, New England. Holmes was born in the year 1607, which was 4 years after King James VI of Scotland had become King James I of England and Ireland. Now that year, 1607, was in many ways a very significant year in the history of Protestant Christianity, especially in the history of churches like this church, nonconformist evangelical churches. It was in 1607 that the first English settlement in mainland America was established, Jamestown, Virginia. And it was also in that year that a little group of Christian men with their families determined to leave their home in Scrooby, Nottinghamshire, and move to Holland. It was members of that group who later, in 1620, sailed to America on board the Mayflower and established Plymouth Colony in New England. They have come to be known to history as the Pilgrim Fathers, or the Mayflower Pilgrims. Now, I want to talk about them for a little while. If we're going to understand Obadiah Holmes, then we're going to need to understand the pressures that drove the Pilgrim Fathers from England, and then the new society that began to be shaped in North America. The years when King James I were on the throne were years of religious turmoil in England. The Church of England was the national church, with the king as its supreme governor. And when I say that it was the national church, I don't mean that it was one of a number of denominations in the country, the one that was officially approved by the state. I mean that the only religious activity that was tolerated by the state was that which occurred within the structure of the Church of England. You could not set up an alternative denomination or an alternative church. Every child born within the land was automatically a member of the Church of England. Every parent in the land was legally required to present the child to be baptized within the Church of England. Every Englishman was required to attend the parish church or one of the chapels of ease. It was the king, through Parliament, who decreed how worship should be conducted in every church in the land. The state decreed that all services should follow the prayer book, and the state decreed exactly what would be tolerated within the prayer book. There was no opt-out clause. No one could say, "I am not a member of the Church of England. I'm going to get together with my friends and start a new church." To be an Englishman and to be a member of the Church of England were synonymous. The state and the church were coextensive. Now, the thing to realise is this, that virtually everybody accepted that principle. Virtually everybody accepted that a nation could only have one church and that everybody must belong to it. The only thing that people disagreed about was who should be running the church and how it should be run. Roman Catholics believed that the one national church should be governed by the Pope, whereas from Henry VIII onwards, each English monarch claimed the right to govern the one national church himself. Nearly everybody accepted that the state should enforce how God was to be worshipped in the one national church and what should be taught. But of course they disagreed then about what that was. You had people who argued that the national church should be run by bishops and archbishops. You had people who argued that the national church should be run by presbyters, groups of elders gathered in regional synods. They were known as Presbyterians. You had people who argued that each individual congregation within the national church should largely run its own affairs within the parameters laid down by the state. They were known as Congregationalists. But they all agreed that there should only be one national church and that everyone should belong to it. They disagreed about what doctrine should be laid down as the fixed standard to be taught. They disagreed about what ceremony should be used. Those who look back to the days before the Reformation, when the Church of England was subject to Rome, those who look backwards wanted worship within the national church to be much more ritualistic, more Catholic. While those who were looking to the Bible wanted life within the national church to be simpler, more gospel-centered, more like the churches of the New Testament. They came to be known as the Puritans. But they virtually all agreed that it was the right and duty of the state to enforce true worship within the one national church. And that meant for every individual local church. And that meant for every person in the land. The way they saw it was that every baby must be baptized into the national church as a sign that from birth you belong to the national church. And from then on, the state had the duty to make sure you conform to the rules of the national church. And what that meant was that the state had the duty to punish you if you didn't conform. Very few people questioned that. To try to break with the national church or to worship God in a way that wasn't according to the rules laid down by king and parliament, it wasn't just a religious error. It was a criminal offence with criminal penalties. And that's where we come to the Pilgrim Fathers. And this little group of Christians meeting in Scrooby, Nottinghamshire. The reason they left England was because they had reached the stage where they could not in all conscience stay within the Church of England. Their view of how God was to be worshipped was so much at odds with what was practiced in the Church of England that they said, we have to get out. In fact, they had come to the point where they no longer believed in the principle of a national church. They believed that neither the Pope nor the King should be head of the church. They said Jesus Christ is the only head of the church and that he tells us through the Bible how God should be worshipped and he doesn't use Parliament to do it. Now, people who held such a view were known as Brownists. After Robert Brown, who in 1580 had tried and failed to set up an independent church outside the state system. Today we often talk of them as separatists. They wanted complete separation from the national church. And what that meant was that there was no place for them in England. It meant fleeing to Holland, but things didn't work out there. There's no time tonight to talk about why. And they decided they needed to move further, to move right outside Europe. So they came back to England, but only for long enough to make arrangements for the terrifying journey to America. And it was terrifying. The plan was to settle in Virginia. They had a grant from the Virginia Company. They had a promise from King James that in Virginia they wouldn't be persecuted for their beliefs. So in that little cockleshell boat, the Mayflower, they set off across the Atlantic. It took 2.5 months in the face of wild storms. And they never reached Virginia. And they landed much further north. And they finally decided to settle on the shores of Plymouth Harbour. Hardly one in two of them survived the first winter there. Starvation, cold, illness carried them away. And yet they came through, and within 10 years you had a tiny but viable colony, the Plymouth Colony. Now, in great part, it was the inspiring example of those Pilgrim Fathers that persuaded many other English people who were unhappy within the Church of England to emigrate to the New World. Some joined the Plymouth Colony, others settled elsewhere. In March of 1626, a group of emigrants led by Roger Conant arrived in what came to be known as Salem, Massachusetts. In 1629, the Massachusetts Bay Company was given its royal charter. In 1630, 1,000 emigrants left England in a fleet of 11 vessels to settle in Massachusetts. In the next 10 years, about 18,000 Englishmen left England to join the colonies of Plymouth and Massachusetts Bay. Now, this is where we need to be clear. The great majority of those who settled in New England were Puritans. They were evangelical Christians, Bible Christians, gospel Christians. Most of them were Calvinists. They were people who loved the Bible, loved Jesus Christ, preached the message of salvation by God's grace alone, through faith alone. They were people obsessed with living holy lives. They were heroic Christians, willing to make a huge sacrifice in order to worship God in the way they believed that the Bible taught. When we talk about the Puritans, that's the sort of people we're talking about. But most of them were not like the separatists of Scrooby, the original Mayflower Pilgrims. They didn't like the way the Church of England had gone. They didn't like the innovations that Charles I, who had succeeded James I, brought in. They didn't like the shift back towards Roman Catholic teachings and the practices that Archbishop Laud was bringing into the church. But nor had they abandoned the idea that there should be a national religion and that the state should force people to conform to it. The majority of these settlers in Massachusetts Bay and even in Plymouth still believed that state and church should be coextensive. They talked about what they called a holy commonwealth. They still believed that every baby should be baptized and brought into this commonwealth. And they still believed that the civil authority should punish anyone who didn't conform to the official teachings of the established religion. They emigrated to New England not because they had abandoned the national church principle, but because they had despaired of ever bringing the national church in England in line with the Bible. And so they wanted to set up a new national church to all intents and purposes that did conform to the Bible. The majority of the Puritans who settled in Massachusetts were actually Congregationalists. And the churches they established there were largely congregational churches. Each church, for example, had the right to choose its own minister, but always within the parameters of the Holy Commonwealth. A minister who preached what was viewed as false doctrine would not just be dismissed by his church, he was liable to face the rigors of the law. He was seen as undermining the whole fabric of society. Now, let's get back to our friend Obadiah Holmes. We said he was born in 1607, that crucial year. He was born as the second son of Robert Holmes and Catherine Johnson Holmes, or their name could be spelt Hume or Humes, who farmed in the Reddish area. Lancashire and Cheshire were at that time one of the great strongholds of Puritan Christianity. Manchester was the great Puritan centre of Northern England, and the clergy at the Manchester Collegiate Church, which was the parish church for the whole of Manchester, the clergy there were largely Puritan in sympathy. And Puritan clergy or lay people dominated nearly all the chapels of ease throughout the Manchester area, for example at Gorton or Didsbury or Denton. Obadiah Holmes's parents seem to have been Puritan by conviction. They had young Obadiah baptized at Didsbury Chapel, which was a Puritan stronghold. Holmes, in later life, wrote about his honoured parents who were faithful in their generation and of good report among men and brought up their children tenderly and honourably. Robert and Catherine Holmes sent three of their sons to the University of Oxford. I mean, that's not surprising. Puritanism was very much a movement of dynamic young intellectuals, radical Young Turks of their day. It was very much rooted in the twin universities of Oxford and Cambridge. The young Holmeses were sent to Brasenose College, a college with strong connections in the Northwest and equally strong Puritan sympathies. For example, William Lee, who was one of the best-known Lancashire preachers, had been the vice-principal at Brasenose. John Fox, who wrote the Book of Martyrs, was another Brasenose man. Well, that's where Robert Holmes and his wife sent three of their sons. Clearly, Robert Holmes and his wife were concerned for their children's academic education. But Holmes goes on to say, most of their care was to inform them and instruct them in the fear of the Lord, and to that end to give them much good counsel, carrying them often before the Lord by earnest prayer. Now, of all the family, it seems that Obadiah was the one who rebelled against his Puritan upbringing. Now, here I'm just going to tell you the story in his own words. It'll take me, 7 or 8 minutes, I think, to read what he wrote about himself. He says, "I, the most rebellious of all, did hearken neither to counsel nor to any instruction. For from a child I minded nothing but folly and vanity. As days and strength increased, so did my transgressions. I became hardened to sin, not only to be drawn into it by others, but was so forward as to draw others into evil as my fellows. Being come to the height of wickedness, I did think it best that I could do the most wickedness. I began to think it was a foolish thing to talk of a God that should bring man to judgment. Therefore, the best thing for me was to take pleasure in whatever the flesh could content itself, in whatever my heart could desire. But still my corrupt, vain heart was not satisfied. Had I not been prevented, I had thought to have contracted with the devil for more powerful ways and means to assure such evil ends as I propounded." Continuing in such a course for 4 or 5 years, "I began to bethink me what counsel my dear parents and my dear mother had given me many a call, many a time, with tears and prayers. My rebellion to my honoured parents then looked me in the open face. And dear mother being sick, it struck me that my disobedient acts caused her death, which forced me to confess the same to her, my evil ways. After that time I began to go to hear the word preached, but every word was spoken against me and left me without hope of any mercy. Sometimes passing over a field called 20 acres, I stood still and said, 'Oh, that I might lie in hell so many years as here are grass. It would have an end.'" Do you understand that? He looked around him in this huge 20-acre field and says, If only I could spend as many years in hell as there are blades of grass in this field, I could bear that thought. But no, hell is forever. When I've been there a million, million years, I'm no nearer to the end. There's a limited number of blades of grass in this field. There's no limit to the years of hell." He says, "The word was ever before me, 'The wicked shall be turned into hell, there to be tormented with the devil and his angels forever, where the worm dieth not, nor the fire ever goeth out. Yet at this time Satan told me, "It's best for thee to put such things out of mind, and take pleasure while thou art here, and return to thy merry companions." And I did for a time, but the worm in the conscience still did gnaw. I went to hear the most noted preachers I could, but found it still against me. I often heard them say that I must repent and be humble and pray, and then thee should find mercy. Thee must confess thy sins and forsake them, and then thou should find mercy. I then fell to prayer and duties, but found no rest or quiet in my soul. Then Satan let fly at me as an adversary, and told me it was too late to return, for there was no hope for me. He told me that I had read and heard that there was a sin which never should be forgiven in this life, nor that which is to come, which sin I had committed. With this, even this assault, he fooled me a long time, even so that my life was a burden to me. Oh, the knives, ropes, trees, coal pits can witness the many escapades of one in a most desperate condition, as one appointed to eternal destruction here and hereafter. He's telling us that he tried repeatedly to kill himself in his despair. Those coal pits he speaks of. You can still walk from Horton Green along the place where those coal pits were dug. He says this: the perplexity of mind brought me to great weakness in body. Yet for ease and comfort I turned over every stone, hearkened to all my acquaintances and friends, as to leaving of my old ways and all my old companions, which thing I had done before with hatred towards their and my own ways. But all this while I never considered sin according to the true nature of it, as huge and loathsome to the Lord, but only as bringing judgment upon me as one man. He was troubled about sin because he saw it would have terrible consequences for him, but he says, I had never realized the real horror of sin, that it was loathsome to God. Yet was I fearful to sin, and began to read the scriptures and be frequent in prayer and other duties. For all that, I had no rest in the soul, though I was in the manner strict as any. As I was enlarged in sorrow for sin, and deep in humiliation, enlarged in prayer or filled with tears, my comfort came in and increased. But as I failed in them, so my sorrow was renewed. And when I looked over my best performances and found them full of sin, oh, then the fears and doubts and questions concerning my own estate, I judged that it was all done in hypocrisy. In this sad, doubting state, I continued very long, yea, many years, and although I could speak comfort to others, yet was I often disquieted in my soul. Not long after this, there was in me a great love for the Lord. But alas, I was deceived in my own heart. He's saying that in terms of his conscious emotions, he began to feel a great sense of love for God. But he says, in fact, there was no sign that his heart was really changed. As he looks back, he knows that despite those emotional shifts, he was still fundamentally the same unchanged, selfish man. He says, my selfish heart was willing to love him and to part with all for him. Yet it was a selfish heart. Yea, I was willing to part with my dear, honoured father, brethren and friends, house and land, and my own native country for time, to avoid the popish relics of the bishops and that filthy, hellish rabble, and to separate from them and all those that mentioned them, to adventure the danger of the seas, to come to New England. That's what drove Obadiah Holmes to leave this country in 1638. As I said, other people with Puritan convictions were beginning to flood out of the country because persecution against them was intensifying. And Holmes knew that he wanted to be with those people. He was a man desperately seeking God. On the one side, he was terrified. He knew he was a sinner under God's wrath. And on the other side, he felt within him what seemed a great love for God, a willingness to love God and to part with all for him. And he felt that the Church of England, as it was, had nothing to offer him. Yes, there were godly Puritan preachers within the Church of England, but he says it was still all mixed up with what he called the popish relics of the bishops, all the rituals and ceremonies. He wanted to know for certain that he was saved and accepted by God. And he wanted desperately to be part of a pure church where everything was done according to the Bible. Now, we've just seen from what he says that his mother's death was one of the turning points in Holmes's outlook. That was in 1630. Holmes married Catherine Hyde 2 months later at Manchester's Collegiate Church, what's now the Cathedral. They had a baby son born in 1633. He died in infancy. He was buried in Stockport. And all through this time, Holmes was going through this intense spiritual conflict, seeking God, trying to find salvation and forgiveness. As I said, it was in 1638 that Obadiah and Catherine Holmes finally left this country. They probably sailed from Preston, down the River Ribble, across the Irish Sea, then into the Atlantic. And they probably had with them their probably three of their children, and the oldest, Jonathan, would have been five at the time. It's, I suppose it's difficult for us now to imagine what it meant for an emigrating family to cross the Atlantic. And for most, it was quite simply an unimaginable terror. Obadiah Holmes and his children will almost certainly never have seen the sea until the day when their ship pulled away from the English coast. People didn't go on holiday to Blackpool at that time. But they'll certainly have heard the stories of what others had endured. You know, back in 1617, a company of emigrants led by Francis Blackwell had sailed towards winter, and barely 50 out of 200 survived that journey. Of course, thousands had made the crossing safely since then. And despite the storms, despite illness and hardship, many afterwards looked back on the journey as an exhilarating adventure. But it was still dangerous beyond words. One of the most graphic accounts of what the voyage to New England was like was written by John Winthrop, who led a party of emigrants in 1630. And as you read his journal, it makes you shudder at times. Like this: "The wind more large to the north, a stiff gale with fair weather. In the afternoon less wind, and our people began to grow well again. Our children and others that were sick and lay groaning in the cabins, we fetched out, and having stretched a rope from the steerage to the mainmast, we made them stand, some on one side and some on the other, and sway this rope up and down till they were warm. And by this means they soon grew well and merry." That was the sort of a strong medicine that they prescribed back then. Discipline on board had to be strict, of course. I'll give you an example. "A servant of one of our company had bargained with a child to sell him a box worth threepence for three biscuits a day all the voyage, and had received about 40, and had sold them and many more to some other servants." Do you see, this servant exploited this little child, gave him a box worth a few pennies, and got out of any exchange 40 biscuits, which, given how precious food supplies were on board, were worth a fortune. He could sell them on. "Well," says Winthrop, "we caused his hands to be tied up to a bar and hanged a basket with stones round his neck, and so he stood 2 hours. That was the sort of a stern discipline that was employed for malefactors on ship. And yet there was lots of fun as well. That ship travelled in company with three others. That was normal. And in calm weather, there'd be boats going between the different ships, people visiting one another and inviting one another from different ships to dinner. And there'd be opportunity for games on deck with the sailors joining in. Our captain set our children and young men to some harmless exercises, which the seamen were very active in, and did our people much good, though they would sometimes play the wags with them." There were times when the fun got a little out of hand, I think is what he's saying. Well, the ship on which the Holmes family travelled had what was described as a tempestuous journey. It took 6 weeks. But finally they arrived in Boston Harbour, Massachusetts. And we know that that autumn a very large convoy, around 20 ships, arrived there, packed with Puritan migrants. At least 3,000 persons came with that convoy. And that's very likely to have been the convoy that brought Holmes and his family. So the time has come for them to unpack their goods. They're going to make their home in the New World. They'll have brought with them their most treasured possessions. We know of at least one item the Holmes family brought with them. They brought a long case pendulum clock, grandfather clock, and I'm told it was the first pendulum clock in North America. It's in existence still, and I know that until fairly recently it was still working. I don't know if it still is. I've sent an email to the museum where it's stored in Brooklyn, New York, to find out if it's still ticking, but I've not had an answer yet. But that clock is still there, kept by the Brooklyn Historical Society, the first pendulum clock in North America. Not extraordinary that a clock that once stood in a farmhouse in Reddish has the place of honour 350 years later in the Brooklyn Museum. Well, by the following January, Obadiah and Catherine had moved on from Boston to Salem. By this time, Salem was a town of around 1,000 inhabitants, and that was where they planned to make their home. On the 21st of January, Holmes was given a grant of 1 acre of land with a promise of another 10 to come. And Holmes began working as a glassmaker. That was his trade back here in England. You can still find the site at Horton Green near Hume's Wood in Denton, where the glass house stood where Holmes worked. And it was one of the first coal-fired glass furnaces in England. It pioneered a whole new technology. And there's a monument, which is now vandalised, to mark the spot where that glass house stood. It's known as Glasshouse Fold. Well, now in Salem, Holmes begins to use his expertise as a glassmaker. Along with friends, he seems to have begun the first glass factory of North America. The first man to import a pendulum clock and the first man to manufacture glass in the New England colonies. Holmes became one of the leading citizens in Salem. We see him surveying boundaries for other people's land grants. In February 1643, he won the contract to supply firewood for the church elders. He often served as a jury member during those years. But still, his spiritual conflict continued. Now, I can't give you the date when finally he knew that his search was over, because he doesn't give us a date. But I can tell you how it happened. This is what he says, and I'm carrying on reading just where I left off before. He's told us that he decided to adventure the danger of the seas to come to New England, where I tried all things in several churches. And now he carries on. For a time I thought I had made a good choice or change. He thought that coming to New England had made all the difference. But in truth it little differed from former times. My spirit was like a wave tossed up and down, not yet come to dig so deep as I should, or to consider the ground of a well-grounded hope. God at last brought me to consider. He says, I hadn't understood yet what it means to have a well-grounded hope, but at last God brought me to consider what is a well-grounded hope, which was his own love to poor lost man in his own secret counsel and purpose before man ever was, and was revealed to man in his time that there is no preparation necessary to obtain Christ, nor anything to deserve that love so as to merit the same. Nothing could stay or satisfy when he laid sin and transgression upon the Lord and upon him alone. God looked at me as a rebel, an enemy, yea, dead in sin and trespasses. He then said, live through the blood of Christ, be cleansed, and in him be loved, for his own love to poor man and the election may obtain it, for he knows who are his. His good will is manifested before men have done either good or evil, so that neither good foreseen nor evil original nor actual shall hinder, so that free grace may have its course, manifested when one gives faith. to believe the promise of the Father in giving a full discharge to the soul, by taking full satisfaction from his only Son who became sin for us and knew no sin, that we might be made the righteousness of God through him. And so remission and a free pardon is granted forth, that whosoever believes in him shall not perish, but have everlasting life. And all that so come to him, he will in no ways cast away. When God had given me to see in any measure this love of his, then and not until then could I give over working for life. At last he caused me to say, from life I must work. Life given alone by himself, who paid so dear a price as to lay down his own blood to wash, cleanse and purify the soul, and to redeem to God both soul and body to serve the Lord. That is now the life I live, by the faith of the Son of God. This faith causes works of faith, or rather fruit that flows from that root, so that now love hath constrained me to yield myself to live as to a king, so that he can rule me by his own holy laws and commandments. This love shed abroad in my heart brought in me a restless desire to know his will, that I might show forth the praises and glory that had called me by his grace. There was a point when Obadiah Holmes at last realized the truth that salvation really is a free gift given to those whom God has chosen before the foundation of the world, given freely by God's grace alone, bought by the blood of Christ, paid for by his suffering and death, not to be worked for, not to be earned, not to be deserved. There was a time when Holmes found a well-grounded hope resting on that saving love. And from that moment on, Holmes says, I was still restless. But now he was restless in a new way. Before, he was restless because he wanted to earn favour with God. Now he says, I was restless to show forth the praises and glory of him that had called me by his grace. He says, I was no longer trying to work for life. In order to gain life, I was working from life. I'd been given life now, and that drove me to work for the one who had saved me. No longer working in order to get himself saved, but working now out of gratitude to the God who had given him free salvation. Now that restlessness to know God's will and to do it, took Holmes in a very different direction from the way that he expected. And in the second half of this lecture, we're going to talk about the new direction that his life took from there on.